This is our last week in session one, and session one is a kind of introduction to the TSK, not only the TSK style of inquiry, but what I think becomes very clear actually in this reading and hopefully in the discussion we're going to have is, what is TSK for and how does it work? And then the rest of the program, you could say, will be about exploring that in a very practical way. The how can we let the TSK vision, how can we activate it? That, after all, is the grounding theme for us. How can we activate knowledge and how can we activate the vision? Okay. So, I want to start with a point that I think is really kind of simple in a way, but also really fundamental. The reading on page 30 says, it starts off by asking us, to be ready to look at how our ordinary views of time, space, and knowledge operate. And right at the top of page 30, it says, do the views we hold make sense? How well do they support us in our aspirations and our activities? That question is the question that is intended to motivate this inquiry, really. If you don't, well, I think we have to start from a certain perspective, and this is already the first level TSK perspective. We talked about this last week, and that is that it is possible to question our way of being in time and space and our way of knowing. So once we allow for the possibility that we can really question those, and ordinarily we take them for granted pretty much, maybe in this kind of theoretical way when people say, oh, time doesn't really exist or something like that, we say, well, that would be very interesting and maybe very fruitful and rewarding if I had that experience, but that's not, maybe someday I'll have that experience. That's not what the TSK form of inquiry is about. TSK is saying, right now we have a certain way of embodying time and space, our way of being, our way of existing, grows out of an understanding of time and space, and there is a knowledge that supports that and a knowledge that contributes to it and in turn is formed by our way of being in time and space. So right now all that is going on. Once we allow for the possibility that it might be different, then we have to ask the question, well, what difference would that difference make? If we had a different orientation to time and space and knowledge, how would that make a difference for us? And so that's really the question that we're going to ask. But the first question is, do we care? Do we have a sense, once we're tuned in to how we are in time and space, do we have a sense that makes a has negative consequences, or maybe more than negative, we'd like to say limiting consequences, and so there's quite a bit of discussion in the TSK books which is intended to I think open up that point, to help us understand or investigate that point. So here it's just put in the form of a question. Do these views, number one, do they make sense? Maybe that's not so motivating, because if we don't think there's any alternative. But number one, do they make sense? Number two, how well do they support us in our aspirations and our activities? That makes a real difference. If we can investigate what it means to be holding these views, and we say, this is an obstacle. There are limits on what's possible, and those limits trace back to our way of understanding time and space and knowledge, now we're motivated to do some inquiry. And then the next question, which is really another way of phrasing it, what are the consequences of operating with this ordinary way of understanding? So that's the question we start off with. And one of the points that we want to get into a little more as we move along today is the idea that, you know, you're not trying to improve your situation necessarily, although that's our usual way of thinking about, you know, why would anybody spend time studying a set of books like this? We're not necessarily trying to improve our situation. We're not necessarily wanting to activate a new way of being in time and space and knowledge. You know, it's a little bit disingenuous, excuse that word, you know, to say, well, we don't want to change. Yeah, we start off with the idea, having recognized that there are certain limits, it would be great to be able to penetrate those limits or set them aside. But just asking the question is really enough, and that really is what TSK has to tell us. If we ask the question, you know, you read a book like this, or if you've read around in the TSK books, and it may seem that a question like this that says, do the views we hold support us in our aspirations and our activities? It may seem as though that's a rhetorical question, a question where we're already supposed to know the answer. Nobody could disagree. Of course, we're reading these books, we're interested in this vision, and it's because we really would... you know, have a sense of limitation in our usual way of engaging time and space and knowledge. But it's not a rhetorical question. We're meant to ask it in a very deep way. We're meant to say, well, can we see how it is that our particular understanding limits what's possible for us? And can we see how, you know, what those limits are made of? One of the things, we'll look at this a little while later, one of the things we could say that is that the limits themselves are an expression of knowledge. And that changes everything once you take that approach. But you really need to ask the question. You know, not just say, well, yes, I understand. That's what we want to get rid of. That's what we want to do differently. If you do that, you've kind of skipped right past the central point, you could say. You know, you've skipped past the need to investigate the operation of time and space and knowledge. So this discussion at the beginning of the reading that we had for today is an example, one of the many places where Rinpoche talks about how our current understanding operates. And he does that in terms of sequences of cause and effect. That's in the first full paragraph on page 30. We're subject to those sequences. We have no way to change them. We make different kinds of distinctions, such as better than or lower than. And now we find ourselves in conflict situations. We limit in advance the kinds of answers that we can arrive at because we've already limited our understanding of what's possible. And then we're left with these consequences. I'm really just kind of summarizing what's on page 30 here. We're left with the consequence that we only have a few choices. We can accept or reject. We can determine the way things are. That is, we can set very specific identities in place, or we can remain ignorant. And you know, we're so used to doing that, as the text says, that we don't even realize that we're limiting ourselves. So that's a kind of a pre-first level understanding. The first level understanding is when we see that there are some limitations in place. And that's what it says at the very bottom of page 30, simply by identifying ordinary time-space knowledge as first level, it challenges the implicit assumption that there is no other way to be. So we looked at this point last week in terms of the statement, I think on page 111 of the first TSK book, first level space, it says there, is our ordinary space seen in the light of other possibilities. We don't want to close down possibilities prematurely. That's what first level space is about. And that's something that we can constantly be investigating in our experience. That is, the ways that we encounter the world, how do they reflect a particular understanding of time and space and knowledge? And the books give us many, many, many ways to explore that question. That's the level, you could say, a first level inquiry. You're bringing to light these other possibilities. Now, the second level, and this is something I want to spend a little time on, because the more I worked with this material preparing for class today, the more I realized that this is really a very central and important formulation that's presented here. So, second level, time, space, and knowledge. What's that about? What it says at the top of page 31 is that, and we already talked about this, is that second level is not about trying to establish a different framework. It's not about trying to improve our situation, as it says there. It's not about changing our focal setting. We haven't talked a lot about focal setting in here, but those of you who are familiar with the first book, but it comes up in other books also, the focal setting being our usual orientation, our first level orientation. So one response would be to say, well, let's change that orientation. Let's change our focal setting. Let's adopt a more fruitful focal setting. That would be one approach. And you could say that approach would kind of grow naturally out of the second level, out of a first level of understanding. We see there are certain other possibilities, or we see that there are maybe unlimited possibilities, and we try to put them into effect. That's a first level way of proceeding. What is being said here is that the second level is different. It doesn't do it that way. It doesn't try to change the framework or focal setting. Instead, it says it invites us to see the world in a new light. And then it gives an example, and I want to spend some time on this example, trying to clarify what I understand here anyway. It may not be correct, but my understanding. It's talking about space and space being pervasive. So it says second-level knowledge sees space as pervasive, encompassing all appearance without ever appearing as something. And then it talks about time as being unified and existence as being the union of time and space, the presence of reality. I want to focus mostly on the first statement about space being pervasive. So you might say, well, you know, that's a different focal setting or a different framework. Instead of focusing on the objects in space, we focus on space and we realize that space is pervasive. Instead of focusing on the qualities and characteristics of the things that appear in space, we shift our focus to space itself because we realize that space is pervasive and whatever appears in space is pervaded by space, and so we can just as well focus on the space dimension of our experience as on the usual focus we have, which is on the object level of our experience. That's fine. Is that a statement or a or noise? Okay. I'm going to assume that it's noise. Okay. So you could say we want to understand the quality of space as pervasive. But that is not, I don't think, even though that's a legitimate way of proceeding, that would be a way in which you adopted a different focal setting or a different framework. And you can do that, and it's very helpful. But it's still operating within the first level parameters. At least that's what I think is being said here. When the text talks here about space as being pervasive. What it's saying is that that space, the pervasiveness of space, means that no framework has substance. No framework or focal setting is, you could say, is better than any other. You know, we started off with this idea that we're not trying to improve our situation. We're just seeing things in a new light and put in terms of space that new light perspective is expressed by saying that space is pervasive. There's, in a sense, you could say, nothing has ever happened. Nothing is happening, nothing has happened, nothing will happen, nothing is there, nothing is real. Why? Because space is pervasive. That's not, at that level, that's not a first-level insight, even though a first-level insight into space as pervasive is valuable. But there's a second-level insight into the pervasiveness of space, which is that whatever framework we establish, whatever situation we accept as real, is subject to the more fundamental second level insight that it's pervaded by space, that there's no, that nothing has been established. And in that light, it's interesting to look at the last sentence in this paragraph where Rinpoche says, the second level knowledge sees existence as the union of time and space, the presence of reality. What's interesting in that formulation is that time and space give reality as a presence. So whatever shows up as real is something that's presenting itself, but it's presenting itself against the background, not quite a perfect word, but against the background of the pervasiveness of space. So there's a difference between first-level pervasiveness and second-level pervasiveness. The text doesn't exactly say that, so I'm giving you my understanding, and I encourage discussion of that point. You know, because maybe people disagree, and in fact, maybe I'm wrong. That's certainly possible. Although right and wrong are not exactly the point. The question is more, you know, how much are we moving toward, let's say, the pervasiveness of space. So the text essay something a little like that in the second full paragraph on page 31. It says, this way of seeing offers something new. So let's say this way of seeing space is pervasive, offers something new, not because it's superior to prevailing systems of knowledge. So not because we can put into effect a different framework or a different focal setting, which is superior to the focal setting we usually operate with. That may be true, but that's at the first level. Not because it's superior, but because it steps outside the framework within which such systems arise and develop their perspectives. So, no frameworks. That's the pervasiveness, you could say, the pervasiveness of space. So, we looked at that last week, or at least in this paragraph, we looked at the next sentence, which is about TSK not being concerned with praise and blame, hope and fear, or right and wrong. It can accommodate every alternative. It has no position to defend and no point to make. And it, in fact, it transforms and transcends such dichotomies, for it reveals the mechanisms of their arising. Well, what is it, what does the pervasiveness of space reveal? Not exactly the mechanism, but the fundamental with against the backdrop, as I, the background, I said, against which everything arises. So Michael has a comment on this. He says, a fish in the ocean might become aware that there's an ocean that permeates everything in its experience, but no focal setting could embrace this realization. This realization is beyond what can be experienced, but can permeate everything known. Yes, I think that's a great example. Fish don't understand water is a kind of a statement you hear sometimes. And in this context, that's a perfect analogy. Let's say the fish discovers the existence, we can't say it that way. Let's say the fish discovers the ocean. Can the fish go to other fish and say, I've discovered something new? I've discovered the existence of something called the ocean? No, it can't, because the ocean doesn't exist in the fish's world, right? The ocean is just the pervasive background. I'm gonna stick with that term for now until I come up with a better one. So there's a place, there's a term that Rinpoche uses here as a technical term, and I want to call attention to it because I think it'll help clarify this point. It's a pretty subtle point, and investigating what it means is a process, an ongoing process, and we'll be spending the rest of the program, and once you sign up, you can say spending the rest of your life. I don't want to scare anybody off, but it's an ongoing inquiry. It's not just because you're not going to arrive at answers, right? There is no answer. There is no this. You can't say this is this, this is that, this is better than than that. None of that works. That's all within the domain of the first level and the possibility that the first level could be different. That's all fine and good and worth exploring. And in fact, a lot of the TSK materials, the exercises, the reading do explore that. But they do it in the service of moving toward this, you could say, deeper second level realization. So the way that Rinpoche talks about that at the bottom of page 32 is in terms of the prior. And he doesn't say much about it here. I didn't actually check to see in this book or in other books. I think the term prior is discussed in more detail elsewhere, but I'm just going to go with what it says here. It says, one way to suggest what second level time, space, and knowledge offer is to say that there is a prior to ignorance and suffering, that knowledge is always available to add value to our lives and introduce the chance for virtue, meaning, and joy. A second level presentation of TSK aims to invoke this power of knowledge by loosening up the givens of first level time and space and engaging knowledge directly. And then it says something that I'll turn to in a moment, but about imagination, but let's just stay there for a moment. A lot of what the TSK vision is about, and a lot of what we're going to be exploring in future sessions now, is this sense of loosening up the givens of first level time and space and engaging knowledge directly. How do you do that? Well, you see, you ask the question, what would it be like if knowledge, or let's say if time and space were not given in the way that we usually think of them as being given, or we don't usually think of them at all, if time and space were not given in the way that we think they are, how can we loosen them up? Well, let's do this exercise, or let's read this description, a particular description of how past and present and future operate and really reflect on it. Or let's engage in any sort of an inquiry. But the books are all about activating that kind of inquiry because it's about engaging knowledge directly. And maybe I will go ahead to the end of that paragraph. It goes on, this is the top of page 33, it says, aware that higher level knowledge cannot be directly introduced in first level terms. Why? Well, in the same way that you can't introduce the ocean to other fish, right, or even to yourself. It's not a thing. Aware that higher level knowledge cannot be directly introduced in first level terms, it relies on inspiration and imagination as vehicles for transformation. So what are the methods you have available? Well, you conduct inquiry. You ask questions. You investigate. And you do that by relying on your imagination and on the inspiration of a particular vision or the inspiration that comes through questioning when you realize that nothing is firm and solid and fixed. So you're really dropping down below any sense that this is this and that is that, or causality, or the various things we talked about a few minutes ago that are characteristic of having a particular focal setting, and that will continue even if you change your focal setting. You're dropping down below all of that. So I think it's maybe in the comment to exercise 16, which I want to turn to now. I have this quote, but I can't remember where it comes from. It says, existing is a very lonely, isolationist tendency. What we're talking about is something that doesn't depend on existing, and it doesn't depend on not existing, and it doesn't depend on going beyond existing, or, you know, as they would say in the Buddhist texts, it doesn't depend on both existing and not existing, or neither existing and not existing. You know, whatever, the moment you've introduced the notion of existing and not existing, you've got a problem. This is deeper than that. This is not about that level of inquiry. Or you could do an inquiry, absolutely, into what it means to exist or what it means not to exist or what the various possibilities are for existing. But in doing that, you're aiming to move toward a prior, right? And it's a prior, I think Rinpoche uses the term prior, which is not a very complicated word in English, but it's not the usual word. Usually we'd say before. I think he uses the word prior here because he wants to engage this other level. It's not a before in time. It's not a before in terms of cause and effect. It's a prior in which none of those are yet operating. So I want us to explore this a little bit because I realize that, you know, it can sound abstract. It's absolutely not intended to be abstract, and in fact it isn't. You know, what he's saying here is not something theoretical. It's about how we engage every moment of our experience. I want to do that in terms of exercise 16, which was the assignment for this week. But let me look first at a question that Caroline is asking. Could the prior be compared to the ocean and existence to the fish? Yes, that's exactly right. The prior is, you know, the presupposition. Existence is maybe, you could say the fish, but you also want to say, you know, the plants at the bottom of the ocean and the plankton that swarm through the ocean and you know, the various kinds of food and junk, because increasingly in the ocean there's a lot of junk. Everything that exists, that's, you know, everything that you find, you know, so there's this nice word in English. I know it's the same in German. I don't know about other languages exactly, but this nice word of, you know, something is given in advance, we say. It's a nice phrase, I guess. Or when we use the word data, which we do in the computer world all the time, that word is just the Latin for given, you know. Certain things are given, and those givens are, you know, they define what it means to exist and not to exist. But we want to go, you might say, to the given and giving of the given, although maybe even that is saying a little too much. Okay, so exercise 16, which is called Time, Space, and Knowledge on the Ordinary Level, there's a couple of additional points. Bruce says to exist means to stand out. Yeah, exactly. Ex-ist, as Bruce points out here. So there are things that stand out from an undifferentiated whole. But you need to be a little careful, and the image of the ocean, I think, is very helpful there. It's not as though the ocean is an undifferentiated whole and then things stand out from that, the things that exist. The only thing that's wrong with that image is that, you know, now you're talking about something that exists in a particular way as an undifferentiated whole. And that's not right either. We're talking about something that is prior to existence. And then Sudhi says, prior to congealing and solidifying or zooming in to a specific. Yes, that's right. The prior to all of that, I think I would add to that, you know, prior to the framework, the whole framework, because it's not just that a framework allows various things to appear and but not other things, but the framework itself is there, even if it's not really identified as that. It's not the ocean. It's sort of, you know, if a fish looks around and says, well, what do I take, you know, what do I know to be real around me? And I don't know what a fish would answer to that question, but, you know, I don't even know what a human being would answer, but we'd sort of have a sense, you know, here I am, I'm alive, I'm in the world, there's earth and air and sky and wind and water and fire and so on. All of that is kind of the given. That's the framework for the given. So it's not only the specifics. It's not only zooming into specifics, I think. It's also that framework. Okay, so let's go to exercise 16, time, space, and knowledge on the ordinary level. And I want to just go to the very first part of it because we're just going to take a couple of minutes for it now. And I'm going to quote, I don't have the actual book in front of me, but I have a couple of sentences that I want us to focus on. So it says, you know, look at or allow experience to unfold, allow time to unfold. You know? And it says, as that happens, and I'm quoting now, let go of the heavy emphasis on here, there, inside, outside, and the special status of yourself as the doer or observer. And then it also says, very similar, relax locatedness here. Relax locating out there. Relax happening now and existence. Well, that's a lot to keep in mind. I've got 10 things I have to relax or let go of. That's guaranteed to make sure that you're not going to let go of anything because you're all tense, right? Wait, I only did 5 of them. I didn't do the last 5. It's more a question of the letting go of the heaviness, the heavy emphasis. So, okay, here's the fish or here's the human being. Let's switch over to human beings. Here's the human being. And, you know, there are a lot of things you know to be true because the framework that establishes the given tells you that they're true. You know, the fundamental thing you know to be true is your own existence, your own memory, not exactly memory, but your own sense that you have persisted over time, you know, that you arrive at this moment through a sequence of other moments. So there's also, in other words, that sense of happening, you know, and happening presupposes what's happened and what will happen in the future. So that's part of what's given. You find yourself in a particular location. So, you know, this week I'm up at Ratnaling. You may tell I'm not in my usual place from the background of the video. And I had to drive here. So, you know, there was the moving through space to get here. There was the going from one place to another. Well, you know, you couldn't possibly enumerate all of the things that are in the background. But all of them have in common a kind of a heaviness. You know, it says here a heavy emphasis. There's a here and a there, a now and a then, an inside and an outside. There's a self that's doing, there's or experiencing or observing. There's a setting or a situation that you find yourself in. It's basically just saying relax all of those. And so I'll come back to that line that I quoted before that existing is a very lonely, isolationist tendency. The isolationist and lonely quality goes together with the heavy quality. Things are set up in a certain way. And so all that this exercise or this part of the exercise is asking us to do is let go of that heaviness, let go of that isolating quality. Everything appears exactly the way it was. That might not be the best way to say that. Let's just say everything appears, but it's not heavy. It's not, you know, isolated things. It's a, you could think if you want in terms of a flow, any image I give you, it already has built into it its own way of, its own framework, its own structure. But whatever structure might appear, it's the quality of letting go. So let's try to do that. It's you know, and it's interesting to ask, why is this practice called space-time knowledge on the ordinary level? We'll look at that question later after we've done the practice. But let's do the practice for about 3 minutes and see what people find in light of what we've been discussing so far. Okay, so let's come back together. I will open it up for people to describe what you noticed, what you wondered about, what you found yourself thinking. Always aware, of course, that you know, the expression of what you find is not what you found. But the expression of it, the stating of it, the formulating of it, offers another opportunity to let go, even as you do that. Good, yeah. Okay, good. So, you could imagine a fish philosopher, trying to explain the ocean or trying to communicate to the ocean something to other fish about the nature of the ocean, and perhaps you'd say there's no obstacle there. That whatever shows up, I mean, this plant on the bottom of the ocean bed, is still, the ocean is what makes it possible. But maybe that analogy breaks down at this point, because what you're pointing to is really fundamental, and I think is very much related to what we're talking about here, that by letting go of the heaviness, by going toward lightness, you're also going toward the point that Rinpoche makes at the end of this chapter about space being illuminated and how that's an alternative to our usual way of understanding. But we may not have a chance to get to that in our discussion today, so good that we at least mentioned it. Okay, let's take a look at a couple of other comments. I'm in trouble getting my cursor to behave. Okay, let's see. So, Bruce says, so I commented that exist means to stand out in response to the suggestion that existence is lonely and isolationist. Right, good. Also, exist is stand as stand out is given together with the undifferentiated background, and thus is part of exist. It seems TSK is asking us to relax that whole gestalt of background stuff and existent particulars. Yes, I that seems to me to be right. The background is always the, I think that's another way, and I've been using the term background, but I said I wasn't completely comfortable with it because background really is part of what shows up. There's a philosopher, a contemporary philosopher, who uses the word background, and people have found it a very interesting, useful term. But I remember an example he gives is that if you go into a restaurant and you order a steak, there's a whole background of things that are assumed, which is so that you don't, you know that they're going to bring you the steak cooked instead of raw. You know they're going to bring it to you on a plate. You know they're going to charge you when you're done eating. All of that's in the background. But those are all great examples for showing that background in that sense, the kind of framework of what it means to go to a restaurant, is still part of what's given, is still part of the gestalt, as you say, the form of the whole. So I would say yes, that TSK is saying is going to a deeper level than that. Okay, Michael says, a water fish made of water and a wind bird made of air. Okay, this is a little fable. I like that. A water fish made of water and a wind bird made of air voted the ecosaurus to be their spokesperson. But without a person calling out into the canyon, the ecosaurus had nothing to echo back. Oh, I see. The ecosaurus, I thought ecosaurus was something, but no, it's an ecosaurus. It's okay. So, okay. Yeah. How does something get called into being? I mean, I think that's a nice phrase we might think about. What does it mean to call something into being? I'm going to leave that there because, geez, we're out of time already. Terrible. And then John writes, I notice that there's a constant, subtle grabbing onto meaning of every single thing in my experience, and this creates significant tension energetically, pulling or pushing. This exercise reveals that mechanism in play and allows it to flow. the slipperiness of time becomes apparent as this letting go is allowed. Okay, well, it's very good that you take us to the level of meaning, and the tension that comes when we're creating this, you know, this, when we're insisting on existing. And it's not only our existence that we insist on, but the existence of everything. And it has that line that we've been quoting, there's a lonely isolationist tendency to it. Now, how that fits in to the slipperiness of time, I'm going to, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. So maybe you have something you'd like to comment. I'm going to look at Sudi's comment. So if you want to write something more, John, that's fine. But and maybe we can reflect on it together. But then we're going to end. Or do you want to say something? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, because I think our recorder doesn't record comments, I'm just going to summarize that very quickly. The constant moving of time, if you let that be in the foreground, then you can release each thing as it comes up. And that's what you're referring to as the slipperiness, right? Okay. Good. And Sudhi says, I saw that the moment before death for ordinary people. Well, I wonder, did you see it or did this kind of occur to you as a reflection? But I'm not quarreling with that. It was like a vision. Ah, okay. I saw that the moment before death for ordinary people has this quality of prior, all past available. In a light way, everything is available. Well, that's quite nice. That's lovely. Maybe, you know, if death is a letting go, and even for people who aren't exactly prepared for that, because after all, I think in a Buddhist context or a spiritual context, generally you'd say that letting go is probably the right way, or seems like a fruitful way to approach your own dying. But maybe even for people who don't have their preparation, whether they want to or not, there is a letting go. And in that letting go, yeah, maybe you find yourself in that prior. That's a very nice thought. That's really worth exploring. Okay, I'm going to leave that there. We're going to take a week's break now because we're at the end of session one, and then we will start with session two. And I will go ahead and post an orientation. And I think in that orientation, I'm going to make a couple of points that we didn't get a chance to go into in the discussion today that seemed to me helpful. I may change my mind about that because sometimes you just have to let go. You know? I don't want the heaviness of some particular presumed insight to drag us kicking and screaming into the next session. You know, maybe I just have to let go. But in any event, thanks. That was very fruitful and interesting. And we'll take this break and then we'll meet again in 2 weeks.